Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
This episode highlights from the Future of Everything Festival, where Wall Street Journal editors and industry minds examine how advancements in science and tech are revolutionizing business, culture, and society. This was recorded in front of a live audience on May 10th at Spring Studios in Tribeca.
The Future of Everything, a look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
The Me Too and Time's Up movements have been changing workplaces and gender dynamics far beyond Hollywood. My colleague, Wall Street Journal editor Nikki Waller, spoke to Tina Chen, a leader of the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund, and actor, activist, and businesswoman Sarah Jessica Parker.
Welcome. We will get right to it. It's been a very busy 18 months. We have a lot to cover. Sarah Jessica, I'd like you to take us into Hollywood a little bit. How is a film set or a meeting different now than it was a year and a half ago?
Well, I spend very little time in Hollywood. I'm a New Yorker. But
there's an applause line.
But I think what you mean is just generally speaking, the entertainment industry and the business environment. And I think there was visible panic. I think people felt very unsure of how to behave, how to speak. I think people felt that they were villains without anybody saying so. I think the culture was in the midst of learning a brand new language, and it's not an enormous amount of time that has passed. I think even for those of us that are involved in Time's Up, there's like a whole new language we get to learn and a way of communicating. What I have found is, though people felt displaced, primarily men, I would say, felt threatened. I think the culture was shifting so quickly that there was no period of adjustment. What I'm feeling now is more a sense of how can we be involved. So meetings conduct themselves. I mean, business meetings are business meetings, boring or thrilling, exciting or disappointing, and those are pretty much standard. But I think the way we choose to speak to each other and how outside on the periphery of the meeting is where I'm seeing the biggest change. Men asking me, how can I be involved? How do I stand shoulder to shoulder? And in various ways. Some people are interested in labor. Some people are interested in policy. Some people are interested in just righting their own ship, correcting their own ship. People feel responsible. And that is either because of what they know about themselves or they've been told that they have been complicit. And so I think what's happening is everybody is looking for ways to reach in and to be helpful. But it's, like I said, it's a new language, and adults are famous for having a very difficult time learning new languages. It's, you know, after 6 or 8, it just is not as easy. So that's a long answer to a short question.
And, well, Tina, is that, you know, you are a corporate lawyer, and how is that changing the corporate realm? Is that panic, is there a similar panic echoing through the boardrooms?
Yes. and actually, in addition to the work with Time's Up, you know, I left the White House and went back to a practice at Buckley Sandler, building a new practice around workplace cultural compliance to help us. And actually, before this all broke, I had an idea that companies actually want to do better around diversity and inclusion, and the tools at hand that we have haven't really worked for the last 3 decades. And we were setting about building that practice when everything hit 6 months ago. And now companies really are taking a look. I mean, across the board, I had 2 meetings this morning with 2 different companies, you know, who want to know what can we do differently. I think boards of directors are asking their management, you know, what is our risk profile? What do we need to be doing differently? I saw a survey that found that 55% of companies have done retrainings in the last 6 months. They may or may not be good trainings, but they're doing trainings. So there is what I think on the positive side, there is an intentionality and a desire to really address issues in the workplace in a very serious way and coming from the most senior ranks of companies that I don't think has happened before.
And what do you guys think is going to make it stick, this change?
I don't think that there's any possibility to retreat. I can't imagine a scenario where we all collectively decide that this was a bad idea. And I think that it's a movement in infancy, but I think the way that it has sort of shaped itself and continues to grow up just allows it to not disappear. I think all movements in their early stages are wonderfully chaotic, and people are looking for leaders and for places and for opportunities. But I think that what we're seeing, and outside of Time's Up and the Me Too conversation, is what is happening in the streets and the cities and rural areas. I mean, it's happening everywhere. And I just simply feel that people are wanting to be involved and be active citizens in a different way. And I also think there is a younger generation that can't imagine that they wouldn't be involved and participate. My son is almost 16. I don't think he ever would imagine a time in his life where he was sitting in a chair and watching a movement. I think young people feel responsible to and for change. And I just simply don't think they're going to let anyone be lazy about the things that are important to them, that are probably important to all of us.
And I think the thing we have to see, which is happening, is, and you've been talking about it today from this stage, is that connection. This isn't just about sexual harassment. You know, we will not solve this problem if all we do is say, we're going to issue some new sexual harassment policies, we're going to do some new sexual harassment training, fire, you know, some bad folks out there, and like done, call it a day, because it's rooted in something much more, which is really about building truly diverse, safe, and equitable workforces that are good for everyone, men and women. We are in the 21st century. We can build workplaces that are more flexible and meet the needs of our workers. We have the technology to do it. We have the ability to do it. We will be more profitable if we do it.
And, how many times, you know, do we have to repeat that,
too? We will be more profitable if we do it that way. All the data keeps growing that more diverse teams are more profitable, that you will have lower turnover costs. You know, if you're investing in someone and training them, do you really want them to leave because they can't balance home and work when they hit their mid-30s? So that's what we need to do, is so we address all of those issues, not just sexual harassment. We've got to deal with equal pay. We've got to deal with paid leave. We have to deal with fair and transparent hiring and promotion and retention practices. So it's the whole piece about how do we build workplaces that are really work for workers.
If you just look, if you sort of, if it's down to its essence, which is dignity, fairness, and safety, yeah, if that is sort of our destination point, it's simply better for everybody. Once again, it's not that's just, I can't find a way to make that controversial. And for those that are threatened by that kind of change and these conversations, if you just want to make the economic argument, because that's easier and more familiar, then all the data exists to support that argument as well.
And you're a businesswoman and a boss. you have a shoe company, you have a publishing label and imprint. And do you design those leadership teams with all of this in mind and with recent history in mind?
Yeah, I mean, I look to be surrounded by people who are really smart and exciting and have a lot to teach me and ideas I hadn't thought of. And so I wasn't purposefully, I mean, it didn't play that much a role in the way I've chosen to hire. But it's nice when I do look around the room, and it is only women. pretty much everywhere I work and all of my businesses, they are all women. I mean, my shoe business and my partner is a man, but everybody else is a woman. And that's just exciting. And it's nice. I think there's something about working alongside women that is, I guess it feels inspiring, because you have opportunities to promote from within, to teach people all sorts of new areas in business that they hadn't been exposed to or hadn't thought about. And I think it's because I was mentored by women that I admired and who allowed me second and third careers outside of being an actor that opened doors. And I think it's, you know, it's my responsibility, but it's not a burden that feels new. It's frankly not a burden. It's a privilege. But it also is just simply something I've always done, and I think it's because I was always surrounded by women that did that naturally as well.
And I want to talk with you both about Time's Up. You have raised tens of millions of dollars and counting to help everyday workers pursue legal issues related to harassment. These are low-wage workers who normally can't get lawyers to take their cases. And right. Can you just tell me about the response to this so far? What are you hearing? How are you helping out?
Well, it's been incredible. First of all, the level of support. We have had donations from all 50 states and about 25 or 30 countries overseas, you know, so it's really taken on and captured people's imagination as a way to help. You know, donations from $5 million to $1 million. But even more startling, you know, we have done no outreach or advertising. And yet, since January 1, we have received over 2,500 requests for help. They come from people from 60 different industries. So it's across the board, from firefighters and prison guards to hotel workers and restaurant workers. Two-thirds of them self-identify as low-income, which was our goal, was to really reach people who cannot find lawyers. And I'll admit, so I'm a lawyer, I'm not an employment lawyer, but this was not an area that was a hotbed for pro bono work, because you figured under Title VII you get lawyer's fees, there's a plaintiff's employment law bar out there, you figured that employees have problems, can file lawsuits. But it turns out, first of all, when you're a low-wage worker and your recovery is likely to be very low, because your wages are so low, it's hard to find a lawyer. And in fairness to the employment lawyers, a lot of them practice in really small firms that can't afford to bankroll cases that will not be able to pay their own bills.
Also, low-wage workers don't have the time necessarily even to investigate a lawyer that's affordable or not. They're working two and three jobs. They don't have the access to the information. They don't have necessarily even the transportation. I mean, there's so much around being a low-wage worker in this country that's unacceptable, that keeps people marginalized, frankly, and doesn't allow them all the opportunities.
Well, and the risks of speaking out are enormous.
Yes.
This isn't like you won't get a promotion. This is the job you're relying on to put food on the table for your family is gone. So I often talk about one of the times that clients of ours that has come forward to and told her story to the Washington Post, you know, a couple months ago, is a woman named Maylin DeVoe. And she was a cook in a hotel, was raped by an engineer at the hotel. And when she reported it, she was fired. And that's what happens to women who come forward. You know, we were able to get a lawyer, and one of the things she told the Post was, which I love because that's what we were all about, is she says, I'm brave now. And that's what we need. We need more victims of harassment at work to at least have the ability to feel brave enough to speak out, to say, you know, what's going on. Because otherwise, actually, well-meaning bosses up the ranks don't know this is happening, because 3 out of 4 victims of sexual harassment at work do not report.
And so many people work in smaller companies, in tiny businesses. I know, Sarah Jessica, you've been working with restaurant workers on issues there and issues of pay and equity and what's going on in the workplace. I'd love to hear a little bit more about what you're doing.
Well, I'm sort of new to, it's called ROC, Restaurant Opportunities Career. It's one of the co-founders is dazzling, unstoppable woman that I met through Time's Up. Mm-hmm. Named Saru, but she's, if any of you met her, you would follow her to the edges yeah. of the earth, because she is so enormously impressive, and the work she is doing is so urgent, and she's such an effective and passionate speaker. But really what they're working on right now is simply one fair wage. They're trying to change the subminimum wage, which is unthinkable. It's $2.13 an hour for tipped workers. I don't need to tell you, that's not a living wage. But there, you know, there are all sorts of people that are very nervous about doing better by our professional and skilled servers. But it's really what you're talking about. You know, a lot of women work in the restaurant industry in the early parts of their career at 17 and 18 years old, and you're a tipped worker on $2, $4 an hour, and you learn to tolerate sexual harassment. You learn to integrate inappropriate behavior into your day. It's what you need to do to pay for school, pay for children, pay for families. And as you go on in your career, whether you stay in the restaurant industry or not, what we find through ROC is that that is where all that begins, and why so many people, why it's so scary to talk about. So we're really just working to raise that. We're really close in New York State. There is a ballot in D.C. and Michigan coming up over the next 18 months. There's much excitement around other ballot initiatives across the United States of changing that subminimum wage. But it's completely necessary for these workers. They deserve it. They can't live, and they're being asked to remain in situations that are neither dignified, safe, or fair. And I think the work that ROC is doing is starting to have real impact.
And talking about the risks of speaking out, I mean, women in entertainment, women who have reached professional pinnacles that you've reached, have a lot of power. Even for you, speaking out is a big risk. I've been struck by reading interviews with you in which it's clear there's a lot that really prominent women can do, but it's almost like women in Hollywood, that you don't really have free speech in a lot of ways.
Well, I know fundamentally I do. I mean, it's still a democracy. I recognize that, as much as we try to rip it apart.
But it's like there's things that you're supposed to talk about and not supposed to talk about, right?
It's true, and I think anytime any of us choose to advocate on behalf of something we believe in is not nearly as risky as many of these women we're talking about and the situations in which they find themselves. But I think that because I can't talk about this without talking about the polarization that exists, and I think sometimes what feels scary is that people don't necessarily understand why you say you support a woman's right to choose and you support access to good health care and family planning, or why we believe in tipped workers. You know, all of this is about things that are about women and often women of color. And so there are very strong feelings right now in this country about people that are different, or people that are starting to have traction in conversations and power. The idea that I think it's scary. I think it's only risky in that you feel, I mean, people say threatening things to me. That's scary sometimes. Or people, you know, you feel, they say, like, I'm not going to go see any of your movies or buy your shoes or blah, 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 blah. And so, but you sort of have to weigh that against the larger picture, which is a society that is about a better life for every single person in this country. And I also think the other part of this, and I will finish this, I promise. The other part of this that is complicated and objectionable by some is that a lot of what we're talking about too affects undocumented people living in this country. And people have very strong feelings, and I have strong feelings that we should do right. And we should do right by DACA and the promises that were made. And so I think there's a lot wrapped up in the endeavors that I'm involved in that are meaningful to me, that are controversial, that I don't feel should be. They're not interlopers into somebody else's life, but I feel like that's what's scary for people.
And even just around Time's Up.
I'm not sure that I answered that question.
That was great.
I was going to say, what I don't want to lose is I give enormous credit to the women of Hollywood. People have asked me, why is this moment different? And let's acknowledge, you know, we had Anita Hill 26 years ago. We've had moments where this issue of sexual harassment in the workplace has been shoved into the national conversation, and it's never gone to this scale. And what I think it is I do think that having women from Hollywood speak up and talk very personally and profoundly about their own experiences gave it fuel, because, you know, we are a celebrity-driven country. You know, we think we know you. You know, I watched all of the Sex and the City shows. I think, you know, a mom sitting, you know, at her kitchen table thinks she knows you in a way she didn't know Anita Hill. And you couple that with the age that we're in right now, where that woman who has her own story, 26 years ago, she could tell her 10 friends that she had also experienced it, and it didn't go anywhere. So the ability, if you combine your giving permission to talk about it to a vehicle through social media that allowed the average person to also join in and tell that story, that then created the ability for us to see how widespread it was and fuel this movement and keep it going. It was a very unique time, but it began with the women from Hollywood who were willing to put their careers on the line, to put their own personal safety and personal private space out there, and to continue to do it, and not just about the entertainment industry, but everyone from Time's Up from the very beginning have been very intentional about talking about low-wage workers and workers in other industries and the need to really use this moment to bring sustained change about to all workplaces.
And one thing that's been surprising, too, I think, you know, you say we're in a celebrity culture. We all assume that all the celebrities are friends, that you all know each other,
right.
You're like hanging
right.
out in the Hamptons.
And,
but,
right.
you know, the surprising thing is that this has been also a moment of community, that you don't all know each other.
Yeah, we realized that early on in December at the first Time's Up meeting in New York. I don't know anybody. I don't have any. People are like, when I'm working for a nonprofit or anything, people are always like, and can you invite some famous friends? And I was like, I don't. If I had some, I would. But my non-famous friends are pretty freaking fantastic, too, by the way. Yeah, no, we don't. And I think something felt intentional about keeping us away from one another. We realized when we were all in a room together for the first time that it felt like a willful compartmentalization of us. Like, stay away, don't get together and talk. Please don't talk to each other. Please don't come together and recognize the places that there might be shortfalls, say, professionally, or areas that are worthy of discussion, pay equity, or any of those other things. It was really exciting, and it's been really lovely to have a community of women who, too, have come from politically active families or are newly active, who feel really excited but also are informed and feel very strongly. And I just want to say one other thing about being involved is that if I were a person that nobody knew, I would be involved politically. I come from a family that was and is, and I'm not speaking because I happen to be an actor who people may or may not know. I'm speaking because I care about these things, and also that there are so many women in this country holding down 2 and 3 jobs mm-hmm. who do not have the opportunity to be heard. Literally, there are a million obstacles in their path that don't allow them to take time off to protest or to show up at their local elected officials or to even come to a meeting and talk about wages or childcare or universal pre-K or family leave or. And the thing I also want to say is that I think we all want to connect with each other. Even if you disagree with me, I would be willing to bet that there is so much we have in common as a mother, as a citizen, as a friend, as a daughter, as a colleague, as an older sister. You know, I think there is much that we can agree on, and I think that is the place that I feel we are working toward. Even as terrifying as conversations can be right now, I feel like there is so much that we share as Americans that I just have to believe that we're going to find a way to talk about the things that unite us, and I feel like that is what, I don't know, that's where I'm sort of hanging my hat.
It's exactly it. I think this, you know, these we were saying earlier backstage, this is a messy time. There's a lot to figure it out, but it's also being figured out, and that feels like a lot of progress. I mean, Tina, you've been on the forefront of a lot of change. You've been Michelle Obama's chief of staff. You've been to the Obama White House. You know, you both seen so much change.
And you were there the whole time?
The whole time.
You stayed?
Inauguration day
just
to
kidding.
Inauguration
get it?
Day.
All
you the get way. Like a special,
just there?
Like a special mug or like...
Yeah.
Yeah, no. Well, so no, I actually think I'm very hopeful. I mean, I think we're at a unique moment on these issues, and I've been doing this work for 40 years, and that I've not seen before. It actually helps that we're at a pretty good time of full employment, right? I mean, it's harder to have this conversation. I'll be honest, it was harder to have this conversation in 2009 when we first went into office because we were in the Great Recession, and it's hard to talk about giving people paid family leave
when people are just shedding,
you know,
Armageddon.
Exactly, 700,000 jobs a month are getting lost, you know, so yeah. You had to write that. Well, now our companies really feel the war for talent. It's truly out there. They need to keep workers happy. They want to, so they're motivated for that reason. We're in a moment where we're having this really hard conversation about sexual harassment. Let's just face it, sex is really hard to talk about. And CEOs have a really hard time talking about it. But we've opened that conversation up, and we're having that. And I think there is a willingness to realize one of the other problems with the conversation in the past is, let's face it, the law... I say this as a lawyer, the law has not caught up with where we need to be. So if all you do, and this is mostly what existing sexual harassment training does, if all you do is train people on what the current law says you cannot do, it's not that much, really. And it certainly says nothing about the kind of culture and the values I think most companies want to project. And that's the conversation I've been having with a lot of CEOs, is that what are the values you want to project to your employees, but more importantly, to your customers, who care about the values now increasingly of the companies that are selling them things. And how do you build that? How do you really build that?
It's 2018, and we look around, and it's like, Miranda's running for governor. And so,
you're running a business.
Yeah, you're running a business. This feels like actually legitimate plot lines. How do you think the Carrie Bradshaw character would be constructed today?
I'm not sure where she would fit in. I think Carrie Bradshaw is very much a product of her generation. And I think her conversations about sexual politics and intimacy spoke to the years she spent, as always, those years prior to being a young adult, inform your worldview. I think that she would have a lot to say about this. And I would be curious to read a column if she could sit back and look at it. You know, this city has changed. That was 20 years ago this June. This city has changed an enormous amount politically and economically and socially. I think it would be a different show, frankly. I think, first of all, there were no women of color Let's talk about that on our show. And there weren't substantive conversations about the LGBTQ community. I mean, there's all this, things changed. And I would be curious to see how she fits into contemporary life today. It'd be certainly interesting, and I'm not opposed to figuring it out.
Oh, there we go.
Time is up for us. What a terrible pun. Thank you.
Thank you guys very much. Thank you.
Thank you to Sarah Jessica Parker.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was produced by Anthony Green, Brian Gutierrez, Kristen Schwab, Laura Sim, and Garrett Crow. John Wurdock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. We had help with this episode from The Wall Street Journal's Nikki Waller and Kim Last, with special thanks to festival organizers Karen Annis, Catherine Sterling, Andrea Acosta, Robin Wood Saylor, and Anna Rafdahl. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong in New York.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.